Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to Flow Guitar Enthusiasts with Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Great tone. Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players as we explore tone and the gear that gets it.
Tonight on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast, we welcome Brent Mason, one of the most recorded guitarists on the planet. Brent has recorded with the likes of George Jones, Dolly Parton, Brooks and Dunn, Shania Twain, and many more. Joining Brent will be Brian Wampler from Wampler Pedals. Brian designed some of the best guitar pedals out there, and he has a signature Brent Mason pedal, too. Flow Guitar Enthusiasts is proudly sponsored by Sweetwater Musical Instruments and Pro Audio at www.sweetwater.com. And now here are your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. We have a great one for you. This is going to be a real fun show. Hey, Scott, how are you doing?
I am doing good. I've been in editing fun for the past 3 or 4 days. I've been editing quite a few Marco Mendoza performances that we had on our show a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, those
started working on the Burst Brothers when they were playing that tiny little $250,000 Les Paul here in the studio.
Yeah, that was nice. A beautiful, and also that Strat they had was really nice. I really like.
Although
that.
I have to admit here live on air, I had a GoPro fail big time. I had the GoPro hooked on the guitar on the Les Paul, and I recorded all their performances. But then I got to play the guitar. It was my first time playing an actual 59 Burst, and I hit the button, but I apparently double tapped it. So I got like 15 frames of me playing. It's pretty awesome.
Well, at least we got a picture of you playing with. So we witnessed that you actually did play a.
I thought about posting it on YouTube as a joke, but I thought that would probably piss people off. Actually, but anyways, So I was kind of mad at myself later, but anyways, but yeah, the Burst Brother videos will be coming up very soon. I've got those about halfway done, so those will be really cool.
Yeah. Okay. Then just let us know. He'll be posting. Check out the Selenium channel on YouTube. That's where he has all those videos, and there's a bunch of stuff up there that's pretty cool. And the Marco Mendoza stuff's amazing. Great stuff.
Yep,
so
he
sang live on the show. It was really good. So
yeah. What have you been up to, Jeff?
Oh, just busy. I've been doing some recording, and I've been bringing out I've been using a lot more acoustic guitars right now. Not as much electric. But I do try to get in there and play my little Flowcaster, which I really love. It's just amazing how quiet it is. So, but I've been doing pretty good.
Yeah, I brought in my little Martin 28 today.
D28. Tell them a little bit about that real quick before we start.
Yeah, I mean, I got a Martin D28 that, doesn't really... It's a custom shop, but it's really not that custom looking. It's just it's got an Adirondack top and Adirondack spruce bracing with its scalloped. It does not have forward shifted bracing, which is mm-hmm. the only thing I wish it did. But it has bone nuts, and it has a neck to die for, though, man. Because the neck
it does
is,
play well.
The
I
neck
just
is
tried it.
It's nice and thin. It's very similar to those retros, so it's really easy to play. And then it's got Waverly tuners on it. And that's basically it. And otherwise, it looks like a D28.
What impressed me about it was it sounds broken in. It doesn't sound like it needs to be. Like most new guitars, it doesn't.
I've had it for a week and a half. I've been playing it for about 720 hours straight.
Oh, okay. Then that's the secret. That's cool. It's a beautiful guitar. He'll be posting pictures up of it, and you got to check it out. It's really, really – it looks like a regular D28, but it actually just plays. It's a special guitar, so it's a really good recordable one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, let's take a quick little break, and then we'll bring on Brent and Brian.
Okay. We'll be right back.
Hi. Kenny Burgle, one of the many guitarists here at Sweetwater. We're proud to support the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Show, and we carry a huge line of PRS signature guitars, including the Brent Mason signature guitar. Check us out at sweetwater.com/guitar gallery and choose your perfect instrument. Or call us, professional guitar enthusiasts, at 800-222-4700. This week, the Flow welcomes big friend of Sweetwater, Brent Mason. Brent does clinics at Sweetwater and all over the country. In between doing major session work constantly and national tours with people like James Burton and Albert Lee and Brad Paisley, his website, BrentMason.com, offers the opportunity for you to get Brent on your own project. Also, we carry his signature PRS Brent Mason guitar, which is killer, by the way. Have fun as Scott and Jeff visit with Brent, and be sure to check out the Brent Mason signature at Sweetwater.com or call us at 800-222-4700. Thanks for listening. This is Kenny Burgle and Sweetwater saying, rock on with the Flow.
All right, everyone, you are listening to Jeff and Scott on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, and I'm Paul Reed Smith from PRS Guitars, and that's kind of what's going on. Enjoy the show.
Well, everyone, I want to officially welcome them on Brent Mason and Brian Wampler. Welcome, guys.
Hey, what's going on?
Now, I guess, actually, I should say a happy belated birthday to Brent for yesterday. It was your birthday.
I'm getting too old now to remember birthdays, and I had one a couple of days ago, and... You know, getting older.
Yeah, and then I think...
That's all I could say.
And Brian had one, too, actually, recently.
I
did.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, 29 again. Birthday video. I made a little iPhone birthday video for him that I think he got a kick out of, right, Brian?
I absolutely did, yeah. That's awesome. Nothing better than getting something like that from your guitar hero.
Well, Brent,
you're younger than me, I think. A little bit.
Well, once again, it's an honor to have you on the show. You're one of the guys that I really wanted to have on to come on because I know that, you know, you literally are like the sound of modern country. I mean, you've been on thousands of recordings. Can you tell us kind of how you got first started and just tell us about your first big break that you had?
That was a long time ago. I was playing at a club in Nashville called Stagecoach Lounge with a well-known clubber, Don Kelly. It was a Don Kelly band, and we were kind of the musician band. And we played there many nights, had lots of people coming in, and Chet Atkins came to the club, brought in George Benson one night, brought Mark Offer in, and every once in a while, he'd bring somebody in to hear us play. And then I got a call to play on Chet's album, which was Stay Tuned album. That was back in 1987 or 88. And I was just, unknown at the time. And he called me and asked me if I was open a certain date to play on the record. And I was nervous. I was trying to act cool. I looked at my calendar. It looked like a snowstorm. But I said, yeah, I think I can work that in, Chet. I can work that day in. And so I played on this album called Stay Tuned. I played on a cut with Martin Offer and Chet. And that was, I don't know if that was, I think I wasn't quite my first one, but I was doing lots of demos for, then it was CBS Songs at Sony now. That's how far back it was. But I was doing a lot of demos and, then finally I got Chet call me on that album. I played on that, and my phone started ringing after that, and things started to pick up. So what they say about Chet helping young guitarists rings true for me. He really helped me get started and kind of, went into other cool things after that, and the career started getting stronger. Thanks to Chet.
Now, since you've been doing studio recording for over 25 years, and country has changed drastically, I think, in those 25 years. I mean, how have you adapted to that?
Oh man, you always got to reinvent yourself. When you go in to play on a song, they might think you're going to play a certain style, and you kind of throw something really good at them, something different than they might expect you to play. And, they go, wow, I didn't think you was you played that or was going to play that, but that's really cooler than I thought, you know, you were going to play. This is really cool. So, you know, for each artist, you kind of listen to the artist and you figure, well, this artist's a little different. I'm going to play a little different thing. So it's more of being a chameleon and just kind of studying what the artist is and their personality and what kind of music they want to release, you know. And so you kind of play, you kind of put that hat on and be who you have to be on a certain record, you know.
Now, when doing studio gigs back then, how has your gear changed? Are you bringing in less or more or the same? I mean, how's it been different over the 25 years?
You know, when I first started out, through the days that Jimmy Bowen used to be the head of MCA, and I actually had a record deal on MCA, and Jimmy Bowen was the executive producer. David Hungate was producing it. And it never got released, because back in those days, that's when Waylon Jennings was on the label, Roger Miller and people like that, and they would get first dibs over everybody. So I'd get studio time, and then I'd get a call saying, hey, man, we have to move that, because Waylon Jennings has got a song he wants to go on a cut. And I go, oh, yeah, well, that makes sense. Yeah, Waylon Jennings. Yeah. So I just kind of held back, and I put out a record, and then and we had a couple singles getting ready to be released, and just a series of things happened, and it never materialized. It just went on the shelf, but I think it was a good thing, because, you know, great things started happening with my session career rather than an artist career at that time. I might have been starving at that, you know, followed up on my artist career. Things might not have went the way they should have, so... you know, so that was back there. But then, you know, I started playing on lots of demos, publishing demos, and I think at that beginning, you know, as I was talking about Chet Atkins calling me on that Stay Tuned record, but there was an artist called Keith Whitley, a country artist who I wrote a song for, and he was blown away by the song and the guitar playing in it. He said, man, I got to have you on this. I want to cut this song, and you got to play the guitar part on it. It was a fast song called Harp. Listen to me, I can't even remember the song. That's how far back it was. Heartbreak Highway. But I went and played on that, and then he was really digging it, so he said, I need you to play on the whole record. You're going to overdub on the whole record. So I ended up being on the whole record he had. It was his last one, you know, before he died, but it was called Wonder Do You Think of Me. So I played on that record, had a cut on it, and then things just started rolling after that. Brian, are you asleep?
No, I'm not. No, absolutely. Not at all, man.
Yeah. I love your stuff. Bedtime, isn't it? Okay. He's heard all this shit stuff before.
I love it.
Right? He's bored.
Well, I mean, so are you bringing less gear when you come in, or are you bringing about the same?
Oh, yeah. That was the gear question. I knew there was an element that I missed. Okay. Gear. Okay, the most important part of that question. All right. Yeah, you know, well, I was saying, back then, everybody was running direct. They had, like, rack-mounted digital gear, rack-mounted, you know, like, compressors and like, preamps, and nobody used amps back then.
Really? Wow.
It was, you know, back in the 80s or, you know, back at the end of the 80s, or I remember going to the studio where Jimmy Bowen was cutting records, and nobody had an amp. Even the drummer had D-drums. Everything was direct.
That's crazy.
And so, you know, you gotta when you're in Rome, do like the Romans. So I had to put a setup together that was mainly direct. And man, my eyes would be crossed at the end of the day trying to get sounds on that thing, cueing in, trying to make it sound like an amp with emulators and everything. And you know, finally it got out of that. We went in there, and I think it was we cut Brooks and Dunn. And that's when the music started to get more like roadhouse music. You know, it was like I brought in old smoky Fender amplifiers that buzzed and stuff like that, you know. And I remember the engineer at the time, and I think it was Scott Hendricks at the time, a producer now, and he runs Warner Brothers. But at the time, he was going, man, it's really good, but that if I hear a buzz on that amp at the end of the song there, it's buzzing a little bit. And I went, yeah, isn't that cool? No. And that always, like, freaked me out because I thought, well, that's pretty cool when you got a... I always liked buzzes on the end of an amp when I, or something when I heard on a record. I thought I was really getting my money's worth if I heard an amplifier buzz. You know, I thought that was cool. But evidently that was not cool. for those rec, you know, back those days it wasn't cool. But so, but we drug those amps, you know, and we had a, all of a sudden things started to liven up a little bit. You know, a lot, you know, amplifiers, mics in front of them, and live drummers, room mics, and everything's started to get cool, I thought, you know, around Brooks and Dunn time, Alan Jackson. And, you know, Dwight Yoakam and Pete Anderson were doing that on the West Coast anyway, you know. Right. And I always thought those records were so cool with Dwight and Pete.
So what do you bring in
but,
now?
I didn't have much gear then. Well, okay, so let me get into the gear. So the rack-mounted gear, I pretty much rolled, I shoved that into the closet and ripped it up and put it in the stack and started buying stomp boxes again, which I really liked anyway, analog boxes, you know. And so everything that was in a rack upright now became on the floor on a foot pedal board, you know, with cords and live amplifiers. And that's when I started to say, now I'm digging, I'm liking this now, you know. This is the way music's supposed to sound. So... we did go from digital gear. I caught the end of that era into foot pedals again, you know, and we started using those. You know, and that's what I'm using now. I'm, you know, I might expanded my foot pedal arsenal a little bit, but it's still stomp boxes. You know, I don't think I have any rack mounted gear that I use when I go in the studio.
You know I'm not to interrupt, but I remember it's been several years ago, Brent, that I was going through your cartage with you, and you know that's where everything's kind of stored. And there was just piles and piles of these preamps and just stuff that, you know, from like the 90s.
Yeah,
it was like it's like a museum. I was totally in heaven. And it was it was just the coolest thing ever.
I
would have
gave it to you because it was collecting dust up there.
you actually did give me a few pieces, actually, and I just... Oh man, it was just amazing seeing all that stuff that totally changed the face of country music. I mean, it was just so awesome.
Well, you know, playing, I appreciate that. Well, you know, playing country music, I mean, you want to hear some big old Fender guitars just twanging and edgy, you know, edgy sounds and some, you know, a room, what you want to hear what the room sounds like. It was always fun to put an amplifier in a room. You know, every studio had a different sound to it, you know. The direct stuff and the preamps all went direct and sound real pristine and clear and kind of stagnant all the time. Sound the same all the time, you know what I mean? But it was always fun to go to a big studio and go, wow, and wood floor and all these, you know, cool mics in front of room mics mixed in. It just livened up the music to me.
So where do you find yourself using amp wise the most now that you know you've had many years and of honing your craft? What do you seem to bring in the most of the time?
Well, you know, I always go back to using Fender amps, older amps, you know what I mean? I always buy custom amps, and I'm thinking, that's really cool, and then all of a sudden I find myself putting it back in cartage and grabbing the basement, 65 basement, and, you know, head with a speaker cabinet with Celestion 30s in it, or you know, Warehouse 30s or whatever, and I'll use that in combination with the basement head or a Bandmaster. I use a Bandmaster head sometimes. Now I do use a Matchless 30 sometimes. That's got a real personality to it. I will jump to that once in a while in a session. You know, it's got its own little characteristic. But the most I use would be that basement, 65 basement blackface vintage original, you know.
And do you
just
use
keeping it freshly tubed and working, you know, as long as it's working, it sounds awesome.
And to get your distortion sound, do you use the stomp boxes that are made by our good friend Brian Wampler?
Yeah, we use, you know, Brian. I've been working with Brian a long time. I mean, I knew Brian, you know, back, I think before he was just like modern stomp boxes, I think. You know, I would give him a stomp box or a tremolo pedal, and he would beef it up some, or like a, what was that pedal, that Sparkle Drive or something. He'd add some
Yeah, the blues driver.
Fullness to it a little bit, and that was what you were doing at first.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. then he started making his own pedals and, got really famous. And now I can't get him on the phone anymore.
You know what's funny is I actually...
Now he's got me on back order. but anyway, we did come up, the hot wire pedal we came up with. I needed a pedal that would really kick in the high overdrive thing, and then one side would be more like a rhythm kind of crunch sound, and then the other side would be a real screaming rocking sound. So we kind of kept monkeying with that until we got it where we wanted it, and it turned out to be a great pedal. Thanks, Brian, and and everybody there at the Womper camp.
But now, Brian, on that channel too, what kind of distortion pedal is that?
We went through two versions. The first version was totally different than the second version. The first version, I don't even know how to describe it really. It was more of a transparent overdrive, I guess, that you could use as a boost. But it was just totally different than version two. Version two is, I would say probably more along the lines of tube screamer-ish, sparkle drive-ish maybe. It's kind of along that sort of tonality, I guess. A bit of a different circuit, but it does have a clean blend in it, so you can blend in your clean signal. All that was just kind of in response to what Brent was needing at the time. Things change, all the time. So it was just in response to that. That's kind of how I like to do things. I like to create things that an artist can actually use rather than just something that they'll put on their pedal board.
Brent, on that blend, how do you use that in the studio? I mean, what's your specific use for having
it's that blend he's talking about. I thought by adding a little clean thing into it with a couple switches on it, like a fat boost, there's a fat and fatter in a normal setting, but the fat boost, sometimes when you use an open back, like if you're just using a deluxe reverb or something, when you use a Fender deluxe and it's open back, one 12-inch speaker, you want a little of that low-end push, but you don't want it real dark or real too mid-rangey in the low-end. And so Brian found a nice setting where you could kick it on that switch on the fat side of it and get a little push on that low end, It was real nice frequency for it. And then I wanted to put that clean boost in because I found myself, if I'm playing through a twin or a 65 twin, it's a big amp, it's got a lot of power, but I wanted to get the little tax it a little bit like I would if I was playing a deluxe, which is only like 23 watts or something. So when I put that switch on, then I could find the right combination with that clean boost and or the clean blend, and then turn that overdrive up just right, and the volume, get that set right. There was more control on it that way, and I could still get the sparkle from that Fender amp, without losing the tone. So that was what that channel was all about. The other channel really stood on its own. It was, once we nailed that real screaming overdrive solo sound, it hung in there. It's still great. And I use it a lot, so that I just wanted to improve on that little edgier, just a little crunch sound, the channel one or whatever. That is channel one, isn't it, Brian?
I believe it is, yeah. I always call it the right channel, the right sides.
Yeah, I don't know, right and left. Whoever's one or two, I don't know, however you look at it.
Brian and Brent, what was the difference between the version one and the version two of the Hotwire? What changed or what evolved?
That's kind of what I was talking about. I guess it didn't come across very good. The one channel, we added the little clean boost into it and some little low-end boosts on it.
Mm-hmm.
So you could blend in the clean a little bit and keep that sparkly sound of the guitar in it. A lot of distortion pedals, they don't have that. They don't have as you start to back off on the distortion a little bit, turn the volume up, the tone of the guitar changes, and the amp changes too. So the tone of the amp, and you lose that cool sound. So when when you're able to turn that clean and bleed it in, it, you still keep that fullness and the true sound of the guitar mm-hmm. and the amp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the left channel is actually still exactly the same as it was in version one.
Right, right. It's you know, you can't improve on good on the best, you know. So it was like,
well, and as
worse, don't fix it.
And as a little shout out to our good friends at Sweetwater, that pedal is available from Sweetwater.com if you guys want to get it. Plus all the other Wampler pedals.
You're the cat daddy, Sweetwater. They got everything over there.
Hey, I did have
a little biodome. It's a wonderland over there, isn't it? Sweetwater, wow. I'm from that area, Fort Wayne, Indiana. And it's unbelievable when I saw that place. I didn't think anything was in Fort Wayne, Indiana. It just looked like a UFO landed there and just, you know,
nice.
Camped and made its base right there. But it's a great place.
So I actually got a text message from my father, which is a perfect question for him because I know that this is something he's totally interested in right now. He's a steel guitar player, so I have to ask your opinion on what it's like playing with those guys too because they're a different breed. But he's wondering, how do you tune in studio? Are you guys tuning straight up 440? Are you doing sweetened tunings, or what are you guys doing?
Steel guitar players don't tune, do they? I didn't think they really would.
Zinger, I love it.
No, are you kidding me? Steel guitars, no. I mean, I can learn to fly an airplane 747 faster than steel guitar. Man, this thing's amazing. But no, I'm just you know, 440, trying to, you know, no tricks. I just, you know, I find myself just constantly tuning. That's about all I do when I'm in the studio.
I think it's
especially
just a straight up.
Where, go ahead.
I think it's just a straight up boss tuner, isn't it?
I mean, nothing straight up chromatic. Chromatic, you know, one of those little strobe things. You can set it as a strobe. Yeah, it's just simple. I mean, I'm not too brainiac about the tuning. I just want to keep, you know, make it stay in tune. And, you know, some guitars are a little shifty on the tuning. It's hard, you know, some, I'm not going to say which ones because it might alienate some people. But, you know which one is, right, Brian?
I do, yes. But you know,
stay in tune. They sound great, but they just don't freaking tune up.
But you
so
know,
that's all we do in the studio is tune up. I mean, you know, music these days is more about perfection. You know,
right?
You know how we're mathematically making everything perfect. So your tunings used to back, you know, like man, listen to Rolling Stones. You know, but you know, there's about two or three of them. You know, Keith and whoever, they were all, you know, out of tune a little bit, but it made it cool, I thought. So, you know, if you're all a little bit out of tune together, then you got a great band. But in the studio, everybody's real anal about the tuning. So,
I think when you're all out of tune, I think it's called punk, I believe.
Yeah, right. Or you can tune it up later.
Yeah, exactly.
With your Pro Tools. How about that?
Then you're never out of tune.
Yeah,
auto tune.
Yeah, boy, if you want some entertainment, listen to the Britney Spears Before Autotune. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. But anyways.
Now, wait a minute, man. I never mentioned any names.
You didn't mention it. I did. And it's, you know, it's fine. I don't think she's going to come on the show.
No. Okay. What?
That's all right. I mean, we'd love to have her, but I don't think she's going to come. But now, let me ask you this: when you mic your amps, do you have a specific mic that you like to use, or you just kind of leave that up to the producer, engineer, etc.?
I kind of leave that up to the producer. I mean, although I think the old Gray 57 on there in combination with something else, like a condenser mic or a Royer or something, is always a good combination for two of them. You know, mic them in parallel a little bit. You know. But the 57 is always like the essential part of it to me. It's just a simple, you know, Shure mic, the 57, in combination. You know, some guys may want to use something else. You know, Paul Reed Smith, he's a mic freak. You know, when I was at his place, he had all kinds of great mics, trying them out, combinations. But when I'm in the studio, I just kind of let the engineer do what they're planning on doing, and if it's totally bad, then I might speak up. But I'll go. Usually, that you know, these days they got a pretty good idea what goes on, you know, what makes a guitar sound good. But you always see a 57 in there. That's my point. You always see that combination with something like a Roy, you know, a Royer, yeah, something.
And he can use the 57 as a drumstick.
maybe a mic in the back, you know, if it's an open back. Maybe sticking some kind of a mic in the back of it, but to kind of, you know, blend it in a bit. I don't see that as much anymore, but sometimes that's a cool thing to do if you got an open back amp. And, you know, we use a lot of closed back speaker cabinets these days. So it's really, I don't know, for music these days, it's so highly compressed, you know, that seems like the closed backs push a little more so you can hear the attacks a little more. I find myself using those more these days.
Brent, I want to ask you a question about your signature guitars. You originally had a guitar made by Valley Arts, and then now you have a signature model that's made by PRS. What was the difference, or how did the PRS evolve from the other one, or what changes did you make in terms of electronics, woods? I mean, what was your what did you want from the Valley Arts, and how did that change when you went to the PRS?
Okay, well, yeah, that's two totally different guitars. So Valley Arts was that approached me about doing one like my Tele, you know, the gray Tele, that right. Mastered guitar I've got. It's a primer car paint, coat of primer paint on it for car paint.
Mm-hmm.
And there was somebody had, way back in the early 80s or something, had taken it into the music store and traded it in for some other guitar, and they stripped the paint off of it, the lacquer off of it, and never did repaint it, just put a car primer coat on there of paint. And that's what's on it now. I never did do anything to it, but I did add a middle pickup to it, because back in those days I wasn't making that much money. And I wanted a guitar that could do everything, but I couldn't afford to have more than one or two guitars.
Mm-hmm.
So I put a baby humbucking Gibson in the neck position, and then put a Seymour stack in the middle and a vintage stack in the back. And Joe Glazer had wired it up so I could bleed that middle pickup in with a back or front with a knob, a little knob down below between the tones and the volume.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a standard three-way switch, but it had that volume knob for the middle pickup.
Okay.
And we did that, and so Valley Arts kind of copied that. They said, let's try to get it just like that, you know, and the only thing difference that I found that I liked a fatter, woodier neck on it. It was a little bit bigger and thicker than my original Tele.
Mm-hmm.
But everything else was just exactly to specifications of that one, the old one. And then it was a really good seller, and then somehow it just fell by the wayside. We had that big Nashville flood here. Wiped out Gibson for a while, took him out of the market for a while, and some other things went on, and then the Gibson, we just was going to try some new things with it, and somehow it just all didn't work out. So, you know, I kind of left that the Gibson thing. Well, Gibson bought Valley Arts,
right,
and they got into different stuff, you know, and we both had some different ideas, so we kind of parted on good terms. And then I just didn't have anything going for a while, and then I met Paul Smith, and he said, man, you ought to come down to the factory and check out some of these guitars. And I always thought PRS guitars were just for the aesthetics, you know, superficial guitars.
Mm-hmm.
I'd always see guys playing, and they look pretty and everything. I thought, well, those can't sound good. They just look pretty. So I already had my opinion of those guitars, but I went to the factory, and I thought, wow, Paul's really serious. He's passionate about how he makes these guitars. Of what, you know, he's using the old Leo Fender the old Leo Fender pickup wiring, the spools of that he had there. He was, I mean, he was like a crazy scientist, you know, that had all these, he wanted to make everything, micromanage everything till he had a great sounding guitar. And I realized at that point, I thought, man, this place, he has integrity. This place is really good. It didn't, you know, they look pretty, but you know, they also sound good. So we kicked around the idea of making a signature model. You know, we talked about it, and that guitar wasn't going to be a Tele. So this was more of a studio guitar and more for, you know, guys that want to get a lot of sounds, cool sounds, and it got a lot of cool sounds and everything. And we tried different pickups in it, and we come up with a signature model. So it's like two different guitars. The first one was more trying to copy my Tele, you know, that I was famous to playing the guitar that I played. And this one was, you know, a totally opposite kind of thing.
What were you going for with the pickups?
This PRS.
On the PRS, what type of pickup sound?
Well, I was just going for, you know, I mean, of course we got the Strat sound, the Gibson sound, and we put different pickups in there, those 408s and those near-field pickups, and those guys at PRS come with this cool pickup that you could flip a switch and from double coil to single coil and not lose any volume, but then have the tone of a single coil pickup. You know, that characteristic, that real nice single coil sound, you know, mm-hmm. and then go to the flip a switch and go to the double coil and really get the sustain. And either way, there wouldn't be any volume drop. I don't know how they do that. I'm not a technical person, but they've really nailed that. So we tried one of those with a shape, you know, like a Stratocaster shape, sort mm-hmm. of, but then wanted to make it more like one on steroids or something. So we put, and you know, here's the thing, guys. I don't remember the name of those pickups. There's a pickup in the middle, that long blade
right
pickup, and I can't. I'm so bad at, you know, if they're not Seymour Duncans or Lindy Fralins or something, I can't remember. But they all got numbers. But we put the one that's in there now. Just really made it speak. Oh, you know, we tried all the same pickups in there, but the middle one just was too dark.
Yeah, it's the 305.
So you get that out of phase sound, it is killer. And the front pick is just beautiful, sweet. And so you could kick in like kicking that hot wire pedal with a basement amp and a maybe like a Bogner speaker cabinet or something, you know, with 212s, and that thing will scream and has a beautiful tone. You know, with the stomp boxes, and you know, it's just really all around a really great guitar. I was really happy with it when we got done with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of compressors do you use? I know that compressors are kind of heavily used in country music, and you know,
yeah.
Which one do you use?
Well, you know, when I started using compressors, I was always listening. You know, Reggie Young. You know, back in the days when Reggie was playing on records, and he had this real squeeze sound, but it was clean, you know, it wasn't distorted, but he had to use a compressor to make it sustain. So he'd use a Dynacomp or something, and I thought, well, that is such a cool tone. That's the Reggie sound. And I hear Jerry Reed using them on funky, you know, wiry sounding tellies and stuff. And that's when I started using them. I'd use a Dynacomp, you know, the mm-hmm. MXR Dynacomp.
Yeah.
And then again, Brian came up with an idea of, you know, putting another clean knob in that. I thought, boy, it'd be great to have a compressor. But you know, those diamonds, they take a lot of the sparkly top end away. You know, you lose that when the more compression you use. So that Ego compressor Brian's got is really cool. I see everybody's using them. I was working with Keith Urban the other day, and I saw he had one in his, you know, little stomp box mm-hmm. floor thing. So I'm using that one. But you can get that sound in, kind of, it's got more versatility, I think. But I was using the compressor to stay clean, but then, you know, if I wanted to do some real wiry single coil sounds with my Tele or Strat, and that combination with the compressor would really make it, you know, funky and chicken picking with it. That's what was really what made the chicken picking chicken sounding, you know?
Yeah.
Pops, you know, with double stops and stuff like that. So the compressor was really important for the those kind of traditional country records like Alan Jackson and all that.
So, Brian, was that Ego compressor, did you design that for to help with Brent, or is that something you did on your own?
Well, it's kind of funny. I mean, I was a huge, huge Brent Mason fan before I ever knew him. I mean, as far as like my son's even named Brent after Brent. Nice. And that's because I was just such – I was on the verge of being a stalker. That's how big of a fan I was. So with that in mind, yeah, I mean, my whole goal, like I was just the guy that was in his garage just modifying –
I own 20% of his son.
Nice.
I'll be successful, goes to college and becomes a doctor while I get 20%. Always revenue. All right, go ahead.
So I mean, when I'm creating something, I'm always like thinking among like my guitar heroes. You know, is this something that, you know, maybe I can make something that Brent could use or you know, whoever. So yeah, I mean, as far as like that compressor, that was kind of one of those things. I knew Brent was using a Dynacomp at that time, and actually he was using a Boss CS3 when I met him, and he told me what he didn't like about
right.
it. Yeah, which is like it's a four knob Boss compressor, and
yeah, and that has a cool sound. It does have, you know, a cool sound.
It does, but
no, it's got its own sound. But
it does.
I need
a
little versatility. You know, I needed to get that sound, but then get something else with it too. That, you know,
right.
So that one you had seemed to reach those goals better.
Yeah, I just wanted something that you could blend in your signal in parallel. That way you could get that really squashed compressor, or you could get a way more natural sounding guitar like there is no compressor, but just with sustain and a bit of fullness.
Sustain, right.
So,
right.
So that was kind of the whole goal. It's kind of based off that Dynacompy sort of compression circuit. So, but it's, you know, you can add in more highs if you need to, because like Brent said, a lot of compressors do actually kind of take off a little bit of high end. So I wanted to add that back in, add a clean blend in, just add a few more parameters that you can really tweak it out. And then, of course, you know, one of the things that we're huge about doing is we source all our parts. Some transistors just are more noisy than other ones, even though they're in spec. So we throw those away. So, I mean, everything is done in a way to make it the best possible product in the end. So, and that's just, you know, that's kind of our niche.
I have to testify that Ego compressor, man, that's the one I bought. I was at an LA amp show.
Yeah, I'm seeing them around. Yeah. Wasn't that? Hey, wait a minute. That was my idea, wasn't it, Brian?
That was.
That was really popular. I'm going to claim that. why didn't I think of that? Okay. But yeah, that's great. Great box, yeah.
Do you use any other Wampler pedals or other boxes?
Nope, that's it. Nothing else is good, I don't think. Do you come up with? Let's see. No, I got a few of them. I even still have some of those pedals he modded in there originally when he, you know, I was talking about when he got started. I use a few of them. I mainly there's that Ego compressor, the hot wired, and the delay pedal. The tape delay is great. That's really good pedal.
Yeah, it is a great pedal.
And the tremolo. What's the tremolo? Sent me one of those, and I got that in there now. So,
well, good.
Slowly becoming Wamperized in there. You know, tremolo, analog, the tape delay is really cool, and compressor and distortion. You got some other great distortions too. You know,
yeah, you have tons of them.
I'm curious if you've tried the 30 something for Brian's 30 something.
No, I haven't tried that one. I've seen it.
Because, I mean, in your session work, have you ever had to go for, like, a Vox type of sound?
Like a Vox?
Yeah, because Brian, that's voice
I
like a Vox.
I use that matchless a lot. You know, I always, but I still really love the, when you, you know, the amp, the crunch coming from the amp.
Right.
Excuse me. I've had a cold or something, kind of scratchy. But I still love, you know, the Marshall amps, you know, and the matchless. You still can't beat the amp crunch too. So, you know, you can also use pedals with amps, and you really get some great sounds. You know, with amps, just the natural amp distortion with the pedals. Mm-hmm. Nice marriage. So, but no, as far as pedals go, I don't really have a Voxy kind of a pedal or one that's supposed to emulate a Voxy sound, a Vox sound. But, you know, I do have some exotic pedals, you know, like the RC Boost, the white one, and the orange one. What is that, BB Boost? Exotic makes some good pedals, too, and I got those on there.
Mm-hmm. Now, Brian, can you tell us a little bit about the Latitude that just came out, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. It's a tremolo, of course, but it's got tap tempo. It's got subdivisions on it. You can increase the volume a little bit because in some exaggerated settings, you'll notice it sounds like that you lose a little bit of volume. You can change the waveform, so you can make it like a square wave or more of a traditional type of sine wave. And just a couple different parameters on that. There's some tremolos that have, you know, 45 knobs, and then there's some tremolos that have like two or three knobs. So I wanted something kind of in the middle that, you know, could kind of appeal to guys that wanted a little more function, and then also appeal to guys that just wanted just basic tremolo. So we provide, of course, settings for both those kind of people to kind of get different sort of sounds. But and it's doing really well for us. It's all analog. It's controlled digitally, but the signal path is completely analog. So a lot of guys are really liking it.
Yeah, it's a cool pedal. I mean, the thing I was digging about is, I mean, you can get that old, you know, older tremolo sound to even get that whole chopper sound, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go pretty
well. And it's also got a tap tempo thing, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But sometimes you're trying to get a tremolo that wants to stay in like quarter notes or eighth notes, and, you know, it's hard to find it. You got to catch it in this right cycle, you know. And, you know, that's got a tap thing on it.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. It's a complicated one, little devil. You know, once you start to figure it out, it's pretty cool. You know, I'm always one that hates complicated stuff. Any amps with like 50 knobs on them, get it away from me. You know, the more complicated the circuitry, the less I'm going to like it. You know, when I see an amp with like two knobs on it, I'm going, okay. You know, it sounds much better.
So you're not a Dumble guy then?
No, I'm not. No, I mean, I love that sound. I played Larry Carlton's on a project that he was producing, and I played through his amp, and I couldn't sound like Larry through it. Of course, who's going to sound like Larry? You know, he's awesome, but it sounds a little mid-rangey to me, but Larry's sound is like, it's like freaking amazing. So, you know, I love the sound he gets to them. I don't own one, so I was just playing his through one session, and I didn't quite figure it out, but it's a great amp.
I'm still waiting for the call from Alexander, you know, to allow me to be able to buy one. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. But
you have to sell your house, but
well, there's that. I mean, yeah,
possibly. Yeah, really.
But so Brian, what now? NAMM is this week. That's right, in Nashville, right?
Summer NAMM, yeah. It'll be this week. I think it's Thursday through Sunday. I think. Mm-hmm.
Do you are you coming down for that or?
Yeah, we'll be at booth 1545. So we'll be there all week, and my plan is to work during the day, and I've got some stuff set up so I can
drink at night
and play. I'm actually going to play a bit on Broadway this week as well. So,
oh, cool.
So, which is the big strip that all the bars are. So that's what I look forward to, is actually getting out and playing music. That's my favorite part of NAMM.
After the show, I have to tell you guys a very funny story about my buddy playing on Broadway with Chad Smith from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I'll tell you later. It's a good story. But anyways, so do you have any new pedals coming out for that, for the Summer NAMM?
Not really. I mean, I actually do have one that I'm just so close to having done. And it's I don't know how much I could actually mention it. I will tell you, it's called the Clarksdale. And it's kind of tailored more towards bluesy type of sounds.
Clarksdale,
which it's like, yeah,
like
the you know,
like
we're
like the town, like in Tennessee,
in Mississippi, yeah. So, so it's like
Mississippi too. We got a Clarksdale.
Yeah, it's just like where blues originated from, you know. So it's kind of a playoff on that.
Oh, okay, all right.
So it's
just so much stupidity, but.
So, okay. So I usually don't do like a whole lot of clony type of pedals. I decided I was going to do a series of just, I'm going to call it the classic series, quote unquote. And it's just going to be like two or three pedals that are actually based off of a few different well-known circuits. But I'm adding like my tweaks to them. So for example, this one is kind of based off of that mid-range humpy tube screamer type thing. Mm-hmm. But what I've always wanted in a tube screamer is a three-band EQ. So I changed the circuit a little bit, added an active three-band EQ to it, and it'll be coming out here, I would say, probably within the next month and a half. So look for that. That'll be the very next one. I also have a bass line that'll be coming out, a couple of bass guitar pedals.
Oh, cool.
And design-wise, we've been doing all kinds of design stuff. I've got a new reverb that'll be coming out at some point. I've been working on another delay, wrapping up on a phaser, actually, a tap phaser.
Wow.
So,
well, and
oh, I do have one of those reverbs. I love those reverbs, you know. Those little spring reverbs are becoming a cool sound now. I'm really having fun with them on sessions. If the engineers will let me use them.
That's right. That's right. You got, yeah. You have one of our reverbs. That's right. I forgot.
Yeah. Yeah. You can get that little Phil Spector sound now. With, yeah.
Well, and if you yeah, guys.
Cool. Mono reverb.
If you guys don't know, Brian's got a new podcast out called Chasing Tone. Is that correct, right?
That is correct. Yep. 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 Brand new. So we're like four episodes into it. But, you know, it's all for fun. It's just something that us guys kind of get together and, you know, maybe drink a beer or two and just stick a microphone in front of us and see what happens.
Well, I have to say, for those of you listening out there that haven't listened to it or should listen to it, flood Wampler with emails, because I have to agree with Travis that they need to make a Univibe pedal. I want the Univibe.
Love that pedal.
A Uniwampler.
That's
pedal.
A great pedal. We can also,
all
like
right,
Jimi Hendrix.
You heard it, Brian. Brent needs that pedal.
If Brent needs one, then I guess I need to get to work.
Yeah, I'm in need. Yeah.
Well, we're coming actually to the end of the show here. I just want to mention a few of the different things that's coming up. So Brent has a clinic in Toronto, and I'm trying to remember where it's going to be at. It's on July 22nd and 23rd. That's going to be up at the Guitar Workshop. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, so that's there. And then,
I can't give you the specifics because somebody's going to pick me up at the airport and lead me around to where I need to go, because I don't know where any of these the venue is exactly address wise. But yeah, it's for the workshop.
Yeah, so it looks
in
like
Toronto.
It's you can find out more about it at guitarworkshopplus.com. It looks like so that's the
right.
22nd and 23rd, and then I assume you're going to be. Are you going to be at any different booths here this week at NAMM?
I'm not sure. I got a lot going on this thing, but it's more like there are like shows going on. Tomorrow night, whoever's listening in the vicinity, the Players are playing that Third in Lindsley tomorrow night. And then, the next night, we're playing Vince Gill. We're all playing at the, new convention center at the Davidson Ballroom. To open up the NAMM show, and there's also a panel set up for questions, Q&A, and then I'm doing the All Star Guitar Night, which is the same place the next night with Miro Anderson, and then the 18th, I'm doing a show at Third and Lindsay again for Little Walter Amps, Phil Bradbury, great amp, and we're playing down there. Vince, I think Vince might do the night. And Dan Huff, me, and some other great guitar players going to play there. And then the next night, I don't know what's going on. Hopefully I got that night off. I can watch movies with my wife at home. But I'm not sure. But, yeah, it's more... Now, as far as being on the floor down at the NAMM show, I'm not sure. I'll probably stop down there and just randomly stop in some booths like Brian's and stuff like that. You know, we always like... Always like make my way down there, and it's funny at the NAMM show. You pretty much every 2 feet you walk, you run into somebody you know, and you talk most of the time. But, you know, visit, and I'm going, I see you every day. Why do I need to talk to you at the NAMM show? We're supposed to be checking out new gear and stuff. And by the time you know, it's closed up. I'm going, all I did was talk to everybody I see every day, walking down, you know, hey, man, what are you doing? Oh, I'm just here. Did you check out the, you know. So it's kind of a big hang, really, on the floor there. But I will be down there probably, you know, between those shows that I was talking about at some point.
Cool.
Impromptu.
And you can learn more about you on BrentMason.com. And then there's WamplerPedals.com. And then are you going to be doing anything besides your booth at NAMM? You mentioned a few shows.
Yeah, nothing really like what Brent's doing. I mean, I know I'll be at a couple of the shows he's going to. So, I mean, that's
right.
Part of my plan.
You coming third, Lindsay?
Yeah.
All right.
So I got that set up with Phil and everything.
And guess what? I got to work. I got three sessions. I want him to get to come home before I go there to play. So I guess between songs that I'm recording, I'm going to have to practice my instrumentals and, you know, on the downtime. So it always happens that way.
Cool. Well, if you guys want,
yeah.
Well, thank you guys so much. We really appreciate you both coming on the show. Hang on for after the music here, and we'll chat with you afterwards. But
sure.
WamplerPedals.com, and then if you want to check out their podcast, it's on iTunes, Stitcher, and all kinds of different places. So definitely check out that. And check out Brent Mason's website.
Yes. Thank you, guys. We really appreciate it. And everybody, thanks for listening.
Thank you, guys.
We'll see you all next week. And
next week is Bruce Kulieg.
Yes, and Bruce and Brian, Brent and Brian, just hang on a minute. We'll be on with you after we're off the air.
Okay.
Sure.